Golf Today.
A lot of people have been reading about the tension. And that we've talked a lot. And I said previously that we were going down our path, they were going down theirs. And today, that tension goes away. The litigation is dropped. We're announcing to the world that on behalf of this game, we're coming together. And it's less about how people respond today, and it's all about how people respond in 10 years. And when they see the impact that we're having on this game together, there'll be a lot of smiles on people's faces, and there'll be a lot more people playing this game all over the world. And if you're a young player that wants to get to the highest level of the game today, you'll be more inspired than you've ever been before.
That was 1 year ago tomorrow when Commissioner Jay Monahan upended the golf world by announcing a framework agreement with the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, which has been financing a rival league, LIV Golf. The final deal still not been reached since then, but there has been no shortage of activity in the 365 days since. Just 8 days after that day, Commissioner Jay Monahan stepped away for a medical leave. The Senate hearing followed a month later with Jimmy Dunn and Ron Price. Since then, there have been a lot of action. Tiger Woods joined the board. John Rahm left for LIV. The PGA Tour in January announced a partnership with a strategic sports group that launched PGA Tour Enterprises. Monahan and the player directors, including Woods, then met with Yasser Al-Rumian, the PIF governor in the Bahamas, just right after the Players' Championship in March. And then just a few weeks ago, Jimmy Dunn, one of the architects of that framework agreement, resigned from the PGA Tour's policy board, saying no meaningful progress has been made towards a transaction with PIF.
And time now for a Golf Today roundtable. Damon Hack, Eamon Lynch, Todd Lewis, and Rex Hager. Todd, I'll start with you. You covered a lot of big stories in the game of golf. How surprising and impactful was June 6th, 2023, and all that has followed?
Yeah, it is hard to rank that day, but it has got to be one of the most surprising moments in the game of golf for sure. And the follow-up after that has been interesting as well, because a lot of the players out here, the PGA Tour members, felt not only were they surprised and shocked, but a lot of them felt betrayed. And it was up to Jay Monahan to rebuild that trust. And it took him months and months to do that. And actually, he's got a majority of the players' trust, in my opinion, back, but not everybody still. And that actually, that rebuilding of the trust has probably slowed down this deal happening. But yes, it was shocking, and the continued fallout and the fracture of this game, and looking forward over the horizon as to what this game is going to look like at the highest level moving forward. Yeah, it's still uncertainty out here, but at least it looks like right now, with the structure that is put together by the PGA Tour, with committees and subcommittees and the negotiating table now actually being used, that there is some positivity towards getting this deal done.
Last week at the Canadian Open, I started working on a story that's going to run tomorrow on golfchannel.com, sort of revisiting June 6th. And essentially, I asked players, what was your reaction on June 6th last year? And how has sort of those emotions evolved over the last 12 months? And I have to tell you, a lot of the players told me that those questions were triggering. So it gives you an idea of what that day was actually like, the shock that players felt. Certainly, there was a level of betrayal. There was a level of distrust as well, to Todd's point. And I think the tour has done a decent job over the last 12 months of trying to rebuild that trust. I'm going to push back a little bit on what Todd said. I'm not quite sure he's as close as he seems to make it sound, simply because there has been, as Jimmy Dunn said, to quote him, no meaningful progress, at least in the public's eye. Like, I'm sure there's a lot going on behind closed doors, but that hasn't trickled down to either the players or the media or certainly the fans. So I think right now, the game, the players, the tour is in a better spot, but there is still a level of uncertainty.
Rex, so much of the focus for the last year has been on internal governance, basically, which stemmed from the fact that three people did an end run around the board on the most consequential decision in the history of the organization. But it's been governance with a little bit of revenge. There have been guys who were upset, wanted their pound of flesh out of guys like Jimmy Dunn and Ed Herlihy and Jay Monahan as well. But do you feel as though we've passed that point now, that now they're actually turning their attention to what the future of this game is going to look like with or without the Saudis, that finally the bickering is gone?
I think so, because a lot of the players I talked to last week for the story that I'm working on essentially said that they don't know the exact direction of the PGA Tour, but you certainly have a better understanding of, one, what the framework agreement did. It was terrible messaging. The PGA Tour has said that. Jay Monahan has said that, that it wasn't rolled out correctly. However, once you actually drilled down and you looked at what it did, it got rid of costly and lengthy litigation that was bad for both sides. And it also got both sides to the table to at least have a conversation. And I think everyone can agree that was a good step forward. And now you talk to players, you start getting a general idea. You hear Rory McIlroy talk about if there is some sort of deal, a global tour, you get an idea after the signature events this year of what that might look like. I think players are starting to come around on it, but there is still a level of anxiety that I think the tour still needs to deal with.
Todd, as this negotiation continues between the PGA Tour and the PIF, does LIV have an upper hand here? Does it become more palatable the more we see a Bryson DeChambeau inside the ropes at Augusta National, the PGA Championship, extending an exemption to Taylor Gooch? Does that give the PIF, in some sense, an upper hand in this negotiation?
I frankly don't think so, and we hear a lot from the PGA Tour. They have been pretty open of trying to get this deal done. But if you look at LIV Golf and their business model, I mean, they cannot get commercial business traction here in the United States because of where the money is coming from. This is an HR-sensitive society, and big companies are hesitant to latch on to LIV and the PIF because, you know, you could alienate the gay community. You could alienate women. There's 9/11. And so they really are hesitant to touch LIV Golf. And they are spending a lot of money, hemorrhaging a lot of money, and trying to get LIV started up and to grab that traction here in the United States. So in my opinion, and the people that I've talked to, they want to get this deal done as well. I don't think either side right now has leverage over the other. I think both of them understand that there is this massive fracture. It's not good for golf. It's not good for both entities, and they want to get this deal done.
Todd, regardless of what that deal actually looks like, there's clearly change coming to the PGA Tour just from the private equity component and the fact that the tour is now a for-profit enterprise. Do you get any sense out there on tour that players have reconciled themselves to what the reality of that might look like, with perhaps fewer fully exempt players, potentially even fewer tournaments out there?
Well, yeah, you know, that's a great question, Eamon. I think that, as you were talking about and Rex was talking about so eloquently as well, I think they've moved past the emotions of June 6th from last year, and now it's trying to incorporate some logic. I think a lot of the players, they don't really understand the intricacies and all the tentacles that this deal has in it. They just want it done. They want this to this deal to happen, and so this fracture can heal. I will tell you this, that talking to my sources out here on the PGA Tour, there has been consistent conversations between the PGA Tour and PIF just about every day. And there are going to be some very important in-person meetings over the next few weeks as well. And as Adam Scott said, and Adam Scott is part of the transaction subcommittee, which has seven members there. Basically, he is on the committee that sits at the negotiating table with PIF. He said that talks are starting to accelerate. Now, obviously, they still have a lot to work through in regards to this deal. Big sticking points. Where's team golf? That's a big thing for PIF. How do these LIV players come back to the PGA Tour if that happens? Those are some of the big hurdles going on in this negotiation. But things are progressing. As to what the PGA Tour is going to look like next year and the years to come, wow, that's, you know, I think that most of the membership is still in the dark in that, and they're just hoping that the PGA Tour and the players that represent them can make the right choices.
To Todd's point, as an exercise, I think it's actually brilliant and pretty entertaining to sit around with players. I did it the last few weeks, talking about what they think is the next step. If there is going to be a deal with PIF, to Todd's point, is it going to incorporate LIV Golf? Will it incorporate some sort of team element to it? But when you look at it from 30,000 feet and you start digging into what Rory has referred to as a global schedule, I think most players can wrap their mind around that. The idea that there could be a 15, 20 event schedule just for the elite players. And look, from player to player and person to person, they're going to have their disagreements. I think most players will tell you that 70-player fields are not the right direction. They feel like what the signature events have become probably need to expand a little bit. They feel like 100 players, 120 players is probably a better number. But that's just a conversation. And I think the point that players are getting at is they're starting to open their mind to the idea that there could be a global schedule, that you could end up with essentially two types of PGA Tours. You would have the global tour, and then you would have whatever's left of the PGA Tour B, let's call it. So I do think these conversations are ongoing, and it does create an opportunity that if the tour and PIF can come together, imagine what they could create.
Rex, is there less anger, though, among the membership of what you called PGA Tour B? I can see a Rory McIlroy or a Scottie Scheffler or a Xander Schauffele embracing a global schedule, but there's always, even before June 6, 2023, been a sense that the guy 100, 110, 115, kind of wondering where is his PGA Tour? Is there less anger among the rank and file than there was maybe a year ago or even at the onset of the signature events?
I don't know if anger is the right word, Damon, but I will say confusion. And certainly that brings a lot of unknowns. And when you're talking about your job, you're talking about your financial stability, you're talking about your family, I think a lot of players are starting to feel that right now. And it doesn't matter. I think Justin Thomas is probably the best example. He didn't finish inside that magic number last year. So he's had to, try to stay inside the top 30 in the world ranking, which gets him into the signature events, or he needs to talk to tournaments about trying to get sponsor invitations. So you get an idea of exactly how difficult this must be for the players. Again, this goes back to the idea that most players will tell you 70-man fields are probably not optimal, but when you start expanding it, and if we were to go to 120-man fields, and at that point you do have options. If you don't have the global tour, there would be another tour for you to play your way on. There has to be promotion and relegation. Everyone seems to agree on that front. But yeah, certainly you have players that are worried about what their future is going to look like.
Yeah, and to follow up on what Rex was talking about, I don't think a majority of the players are, you know, upset. But there are some players out here, maybe a minority, that are frustrated that they're not getting the same opportunities as those behind me playing in this signature event. Like, for example, if you did not qualify for the U.S. Open and you're not in these signature events, you're sitting on the couch for 3 weeks. You're not playing this event, you're not playing the U.S. Open, and you're not playing the Travelers the following week. So that limits your opportunity to gain some FedEx Cup points, which are basically the currency out here on the PGA Tour, and try to make it not only to the playoffs, but also to try to get inside the top 50 to set yourself up a schedule to play in signature events for next year. So there is a minority, I feel like, of players, the rank and file, as we have described them, who feel like they're not getting the opportunity that they deserve as a PGA Tour full member.
Rex, in the weeks and perhaps even the months after the framework agreement last year, it was difficult to find many people in this game who thought Jay Monahan would remain as PGA Tour commissioner. Do you get the sense now that he has survived that period of uncertainty and that he's probably more secure in his job now than he might have been a year ago?
I would think so. And again, this is sort of the palace intrigue that we've talked about over the last 12 months. But you look at how significant it was for the PGA Tour, one, to create PGA Tour Enterprises, the for-profit entity that has allowed them to go after private equity as well as a possible deal with the public investment fund. And two, who they ended up coming to an agreement with, and that's the SSG, as you pointed out. And that was always going to be good for Jay Monahan. SSG is led largely by Fenway Sports. Jay Monahan essentially started his career at Fenway Sports, so you would think there would be some sort of agreement there. And I think most players, to Todd's point, have come to the conclusion that whatever is going to come next, that the current leadership is probably in place right now. As part of everything we've talked about over the last 12 months, sort of behind closed doors, there was also a governance review that we don't know a lot about, but this dug in directly to the idea that they never want what happened on June 6th to happen again. And I think of everything that's transpired over the last 12 months, Jay Monahan received that message loud and clear.
Yeah, and I think Jay Monahan admits, well, I know he admits that he did not roll out that framework agreement properly and he made some mistakes. And I think that was a big thing for him to say to this membership. And he apologized to the membership. He had meetings with small groups, one-on-one conversations. He even flew down to South Florida and other parts of the country to go into the kitchen or sit at the kitchen table with some players to explain the position of not only himself, but of the PGA Tour moving forward. So I think he did a nice job in understanding that he did make a business mistake, owned it, and tried to rectify it and try to, again, build back the trust, where I feel like he's done for a lot of the players out here. I think another big thing for him to do was kind of expand the governance out here on the PGA Tour. I think it was very smart for him to appoint Tiger Woods onto the PGA Tour Policy Board, something that Tiger wanted to do and brought to Jay's attention. Obviously, he has the biggest voice in the game. And also adding some more influential business people onto not only the PGA Tour Policy Board, but the PGA Tour Enterprises Board of Directors. So I think he has regained, as I mentioned earlier, the majority of the players' trust out here. And they're hoping that he leads them in the right direction as this deal continues to hopefully establish.
Todd, sports fans of a certain vintage will remember baseball strikes, NFL walkouts, holdouts, labor strife, unrest. How much has the last year plus 2 years hurt professional golf from a soulful viewership, connectivity, storyline standpoint?
Yeah, I think it has hurt in some ways. I mean, fans want to watch sports, and we'll stick to golf. They want to watch players compete and win championships, and money is a byproduct of winning. But the messaging over the last year or so has been money seems to be the major motivation, at least in the world of golf. And it's hard for a person who's making $50,000 a year sitting in his couch to watch these guys playing for millions and millions of dollars, and all they talk about is money. They want to hear about winning championships. So I think that, you know, that has been hurtful to the game of golf at the highest level. I will say, though, I do feel like the PGA Tour is starting to trend up a little bit, at least in viewership. 5 of the last 9 weeks, we have had an increase in viewership from the previous year by double digits. So, you know, I think that is a positive as well. We've had some big names and some big moments out here on the tour. So, but yes, I mean, to answer your question simply, yes, what has happened over the last year or so has hurt the game of golf at the highest level.
Fatigue is very much real, and I'm talking about fatigue among fans, and of course they're tired of hearing about money. I am interested that even players over the last few weeks really have told me that they're fatigued, they're tired of hearing about money. All four of us on this roundtable were involved in Monday's golf's longest day, and I can't tell you how many players I had come up to me. I was at the Canadian site, which had a lot of PGA Tour players on it, and say, this is what pro golf should be about. This is meritocracy at its best. This is where you get to keep what you catch. And this is the way the future of the game should look, not some sort of limited tour with just the stars making tons and tons of money and that's all we're talking about. They know that's not the right way to go. So if nothing else, the last 12 months have certainly been a lesson that the PGA Tour and anyone else who's going to be in business with the PGA Tour should be really paying attention to.
We appreciate the time and thoughts of Rex and Todd. Rex has an article coming out on these last 12 months on NBC Sports and GolfChannel.com. Todd Lewis will be back from Memorial with some thoughts from some of the best players in the game. Eamon, it's been quite the last 12 months. We've talked about it quite a bit on this desk. Where do you want to go, June 6, 2023 to today?
I think that the framework agreement had some significant impact beyond the fact that it just upended the narrative in the world of golf, because it set a kind of a bogus timeline that no one has been able to reach. And, you know, there had to be some kind of timeline appended to that deal, and it was initially December 31st, and it has been extended by both parties ever since. But it created this notion that a resolution to this was a lot closer at hand than it is, because it's obviously a very complex deal. There was also the private equity component of this deal had to come in as well. And I think that has constantly then fed this idea that nothing's happening, even in periods where nothing actually has been happening, but it creates this illusion that they're now kind of way behind schedule. And I'm not necessarily sure that's the case. And you'll find people who will point out the positives of the framework agreement and that it ended the litigation. It also tried to end live poaching, but the Department of Justice raised some questions about that. So that was dropped from the framework agreement. But what it also did was normalized sports washing. It normalized Saudi money in golf. And it gave PGA Tour players the green light to kick the tires on LIV, because if they're good enough for Jay to go into business with, they're good enough for any player to go into business with. And you saw the outcome of that with John Rahm leaving to go to LIV in December. And so there's leverage and sort of negotiating points being used by everyone along the way here, because the strategic sports group coming in, that was a leverage point for Jay Monahan, because suddenly the PGA Tour has options. They have people who are willing to finance the tour, and there are plenty of other people out there with capital who are willing to finance the tour. The question is, do they want to go to war with the Saudis, or do they want to be in business with them? I'm inclined to think SSG wants the latter.
There's also a dissonance in terms of people who are picking up the clubs and playing golf. You know, participation numbers are up, even as people are probably confused and in some cases, I imagine, upset about how these storylines about negotiations and framework agreements in the Department of Justice have overshadowed in some ways a Scottie Scheffler, a Nelly Korda, and some of the big stories that are happening in the players that we watch and root for. I've been just stunned at how June 6, 2023, and we went from June of 2022 with the commissioner sitting next to Jim Nantz and saying, I've told the players this that have left or are considering leaving. Have you ever had to apologize for being a member of the PGA Tour? And invoking two families that Jay knew who had lost loved ones on 9/11 to go from there to a framework agreement 1 year later and to continued darkness and smoke and uncertainty of what the future will look like. Jay says that unification is important. There's a future, you know, wants to do the right thing. But at this point, there's still a lot of uncertainty. And I think it's just a shame that for a lot of fans who just want to watch great golf and see a Scottie Scheffler go back-to-back at the Arnold Palmer Invitational, go win the Players, win the Masters and the RBC in consecutive weeks, these big-time events, signature events, Nelly Korda going on a historic run, but there's still so much uncertainty in what this is all going to look like at the end.
And if we want to apportion responsibility for that uncertainty, there's a lot of it to go around, you know, finding people on the Saudi side who are empowered to make decisions to actually kick the ball down the field on their side of things. And on the internal side, on the PGA Tour, it's been quite remarkable to watch over the last year. Sure, there's a lot of complexities and issues and constituencies that have to be on board with this, but so much of the delay has been what we were just discussing, the idea of governance and accountability about what happened on June 6th. That's fair enough. Governance is absolutely required, but it takes astonishing gall from some people to go out there and say that people like Jimmy Dunn and Ed Herlihy, as imperfect as the framework agreement was, they tried to do something to end this, and they're being criticised by guys who did nothing but hold their own tour hostage for 3 years by threatening to go to live. So it takes an astonishing brass neck on those guys to hold up a process for a year for governance. And who knows, this deal may happen, it may not happen. The tour has options at this stage, but so much of the reason that we're sitting here a year later with no clarity for fans or tournaments or sponsors has to do with a lot of the internal bickering on the PGA Tour from people who don't really have a lot of standing.
What will we possibly be talking about in June of 2025?
Probably the same thing again.
Right now, I'm going to welcome in Jody Boston, who's helped us so much along the way from Brooklyn Law. It's great to see you, Jody. 1 year on from June 6th, 2023, are the obstacles to a deal, are they still the same as they were 1 year ago between the PGA Tour and LIV?
Well, I assume you're asking me about the legal obstacles. We've certainly heard from your roundtable about the various business and commercial obstacles. The legal obstacles are as strong as they've ever been. The Department of Justice continues to be interested in this deal. They are concerned that if the deal results in the shuttering of LIV Golf, it takes a competitor off the board. What does that mean? Fewer options for consumers who are interested in watching golf, fewer options for golfers who want to play professional golf, higher prices to purchase golf rights for media partners and sponsors. There's been a history of significant antitrust scrutiny of mergers in other sports, football, basketball, hockey. So there will certainly continue to be Department of Justice and even possibly European Union regulatory interest over the competitive impact of a deal which combines LIV Golf with the PGA Tour. The other sort of legal interest, more sort of a political interest, comes from the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs, which investigated the Tour's proposed partnership with PIF in hearings held during the summer of 2023. Now, scrutiny there focused on sports washing, the idea that Saudi investment was being used to sort of rebrand from its human rights abuses and influence or control an American cultural institution. And the PGA Tour in those hearings defended the deal around the financial realities that it could not compete over the long run with a bottomless pit of Saudi wealth. So those concerns are still live and will dictate to some degree how these negotiations unfold.
Jody, if there is a deal, and even if the PGA Tour has been updating the Department of Justice and regulators as they go along, do you have any sense what the regulatory scrutiny period is going to look like in terms of a time frame after a deal is announced? How long would be a reasonable time frame before they would thumbs up or thumbs down?
Well, you know, part of what was very surprising about the way the deal was announced in the first place is that typically in mergers and acquisitions, the parties maintain tight secrecy around the deal until it is close to final and most details agreed upon. Here, the Tour and LIV publicly announced their plans early in the process. The Tour needed players to digest the news and help shape the final agreement. But the fact of the lack of secrecy and the negotiations taking place in public means that there is really nothing yet for the Department of Justice to review. Their review will take shape only when we know what the final deal terms are. And that's when the clock starts ticking for the Department of Justice to make moves. And they could start, they would start with making requests for documents and information, interviews with the principals. They'll have a timeline for extending that process, but they have not really been able to accomplish anything in the way of examining this deal, even though a framework agreement was announced a year ago, because there were no bones on that. There was no flesh on that skeleton. It was a skeletal agreement that doesn't give the Department of Justice anything to work with in terms of regulatory review. So we are still looking, once a deal is finalized, at months and months, potentially, of Department of Justice review.
Do you see any, if at all, Jody, impact in this creation of PGA Tour Enterprises as an entity? This happened after the framework agreement was announced.
Well, it was an entity contemplated by the framework agreement. The idea behind that agreement and now going forward with the SSG investment was always that the commercial assets, the business rights of the PGA Tour would be held by a for-profit entity with maximum flexibility to optimize the value of those rights. So that was always contemplated. And it does give the PGA Tour some flexibility in inviting other investors to the table, including PIF, but even beyond PIF. The PGA Tour itself remains in charge of the game, of how the competitions unfold. And if the framework agreement dictates how any potential partnership with PIF unfolds, the PGA Tour would have the authority to determine how LIV Golf product survives, or whether it survives any partnership.
Jody, the people behind the Strategic Sports Group, the private equity investors in the Tour, they own teams in every major American sports league, which at a surface value would incentivize PIF to be in business with those people, because that's really the rich trove for American sports investment are in those teams, much more so in golf. What are the regulations like in terms of sovereign wealth funds from foreign nations investing in those American teams? Is that loosening up a little bit?
Well, first let me clarify that the government does not regulate those investments directly. There are some government restrictions on foreign sovereign investment in U.S. Enterprises, but those are limited to enterprises involving real estate and national security, not the case with sports leagues. And all of the sports leagues are now confronting this Rubicon. Do they accept private equity investment and potentially sovereign equity investment in their properties? Some of the sports leagues have already crossed that Rubicon. And for example, a Qatari investment fund owns interests in a private equity firm that has invested in various Washington teams in women's basketball, men's basketball, and hockey. The NFL is currently reviewing whether it should expand its ownership regulations to permit private equity investment. So what we're talking about here is not government regulation, but private regulation, the leagues themselves determining what criteria needs to be met to obtain an interest in one of their franchises. And that is definitely loosening, largely because franchise values have escalated to the point that there aren't enough billionaires to go around to purchase some of these teams. And they'll need to crowdsource the funding for acquisitions of U.S. professional sports teams. The NFL proposal that's now on the table does not necessarily invite foreign sovereign investment. What it does is loosen up requirements that previously banned private equity investment. And then there's likely to be all sorts of additional caveats around what that private equity investment can look like, who can participate at what percentage. But the Saudis may be more attracted to a deal between PIF and the TOR because it gets them at the table with a number of U.S. professional sports team owners who are part of the SSG group.
1 year after June 6, 2023, still so much to unpack in this story. We appreciate the insight of Professor Jody Balsam.
Let's head back inside the ropes
for a while.
Up next, Xander Schauffele's back in action for the first time since he won the PGA Championship at Valhalla. We're going to hear from the champ coming up next. The PGA Tour is headed to Jack's Place this week, Deerfield Village Golf Club in Columbus, Ohio, for the Memorial Tournament. Play will get underway tomorrow. And it's a pretty deep field being a signature event. At the Memorial, Wyndham Clark, who's defending his US Open title next week, he's headed out with Patrick Cantlay. 10:05, the most recent winner of a major, Xander Schauffele. He's going off with the defending champion, Victor Hovland, at 10:20, and they're followed by the world number one in that morning wave, Scottie Scheffler with Ludvig Åberg.
You know, Xander had 12 top tens in majors when he arrived at Louisville. Needed this putt, the gloaming at Valhalla, to finally break through for major number one. He met the moment. And then to contemplate where it is home, might want to house that big Watermaker trophy. Xander, earlier this week, with our Todd Lewis.
I feel like I've done a pretty good job. It's I felt really fortunate to have 2 weeks off after winning. You know, if anyone that wins this U.S. Open, you're playing, most likely playing the Travelers after. So for me, having 2 weeks off was, I consider that super lucky, and you know, I took advantage of, you know, celebrating, and then I haven't gone to the West Coast yet, so there's still some sort of celebration in order there. But golf's funny. You just you know, you get to the top, and then of 1 week you beat everyone for 1 week, and then you just run it back shortly after. So I feel like, you know, I started practicing not too long after.
We've had quite a few conversations about how well you've been playing, and it seemed like you felt it was inevitable you were going to win. Now that you've done it, is there a different validation that maybe you had prior to that win?
I'm not sure. I'm pretty content with where I'm at. I still want to win tournaments. I still want to be the best player in the world. So with that being said, there's still a lot that needs to happen.
How sharp do you feel like you are after that victory?
Not as sharp as I'd like, to be completely honest. Yeah, you know, I feel pretty good. Still plenty of time. It's only Tuesday. You know, I have tomorrow. And then we'll be going Thursday, so we'll get there.
All right. Finally, you got this week, signature event, big event, Jack's mm-hmm. event, U.S. Open, and then the Travelers, another signature event. How do you mentally prepare for this? What is a very important run in the FedEx Cup schedule?
Yeah, it's a lot of try to, you know, maximize sleep. I feel like that's something that's not talked about a whole lot. Trying, you know, get in the most ideal sleep conditions. Try and rest up. Don't wear yourself out too much in practice, and it's all about just being as fresh as possible. I think that'll give you a big edge on a lot of guys.
For those who carry a notebook and a microphone from time to time, Xander Schauffele become one of the best sound bites in the game. I want to go back to Sunday at Valhalla, where you put into perspective not only major number one, but trying to chase down Scottie Scheffler.
I referred to it earlier. We have all of us are climbing this massive mountain at the top of the mountain, Scottie Scheffler. You know, I won this today, but I'm still not that close to Scottie Scheffler in the big scheme of things. So, you know, I got one good hook up there in the mountain up on that cliff, and I'm still climbing. You know, I might have a beer up there on that side of the hill there and enjoy this, but, you know, it's not that hard to chase when someone's so far ahead of you.
I found that so refreshing in that moment where he could have pounded his chest and say, I've just won, you know, a major championship. I'm Scottie's equal. I deserve to be in the conversation. He immediately humbled himself. I might have a beer on that side of the mountain, but up at the top of that mountain is Scottie Scheffler, who has separated himself from everybody else, including me.
Yeah, I remember having a conversation, it's probably got to be 20 years ago now, with Ian Woosnam, when he said he remembered when his career began the slide, and it was the day after he won the Masters.
Wow.
His mindset, he'd become world number one the previous week as well, but his mindset was other players, the greats, have the next mountain in their field of vision right away. He never did. He'd accomplished everything he'd set out to accomplish in golf, and the fire wasn't there after that. Scottie Scheffler clearly has set a bar that these guys want to reach. It's almost like watching Federer 20 years ago in tennis, where suddenly he is the bar for the Nadals, the Djokovic's, who eventually surpassed him. And it's not as though Scottie's racking up major win after major win after major win. He's such a dominant player right now that he is the day-to-day standard that these guys are seeing out there. And it's good that Xander Schauffele has not lost any sense of ambition or goals, because so often it's the cliche, we hear it every major, the floodgates will open now. This guy's going to win.
They don't.
Doesn't happen.
They don't.
Almost never happens.
Yeah.
It's very rare that it happens. But we heard it about Adam Scott. We heard it about Jason Day. We heard it about Hideki. Year after year, we hear the same thing. These things are hard to win. That's why Rory McIlroy hasn't won one in 10 years. But the idea that he is still focused very much on what the next target is probably a really good sign for Xander Schauffele going forward.